For some of you, depending on which Christian traditions you grew up in, Advent may be a very familiar thing. It's the time where we anticipate, the time where we kind of prepare for Christmas. For some of you, it might be unfamiliar. Why is there three purple and one pink candles? You know, why aren't we singing the Christmas songs yet? So we believe, or in the Christian church for years and years and years, has believed that Christmas deserves a little bit of prep. And so they would prepare themselves spiritually, and they would take time in reflection and preparation for the significant event of Christmas. So it kind of extends the celebration, but it also makes it have a little bit more meaning. Because for years and years and years and years and years in the Old Testament, they were waiting on Christmas. And for years and years and years and years in the Old Testament, we can look at instances where God, long before Jesus, Mary, or Joseph ever arrived on the scene, God started decorating for Christmas. And so that's what we're going to look at as we take our journey, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, through Advent, is some of the Old Testament scriptures, some of the scriptures that point us to Christmas, point us to Christmas. The story we're going to look at today takes place in a specific point in time. It's a point in time that is specific to the Hebrew people. And this is one of those stories you're going to want your Bible for, because I'm going to hop around a little bit. I'm going to kind of paint with a broad brush, and you're going to want to go home and fill in the blanks, I promise, because it's pretty cool. The period that we're going to talk about today is the period of the Judges. If you know a little bit about the beginning of the Old Testament, you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That was kind of Moses' deal, getting the people to the promised land. Then you have Joshua that got them into the promised land. And that's followed by the period of the Judges. And this was about a little over a 300-year time period where they started to forget. They started to forget a lot of things. They started to forget the things that God had done for them, because it didn't happen to them. It didn't even happen to their parents, and it didn't even happen to their parents' parents. These are stories that we've heard over and over from a really, really, really long time ago. So they forgot what God had done for them. They forgot what God told them to do, and they forgot what God told them not to do. And in fact, you could sum up the period of the Judges, this entirety of this 300-year period, with kind of the last verse in Judges. Judges 21:25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." That's the period of the Judges. That's how culture worked at the time. Everyone looked around and said, "Hey, any way you want it, that's the way you should have it." Yeah. That works so beautifully. But that's a parallel to the culture that we're living in right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But this is the time period that we're talking about, and the story that we're going to look at today is the story of Ruth, and it comes right after Judges. Mark it in your Bible, and we're going to jump around a little bit, but when you get a chance, just read all four chapters. It's a really great story. The book of Ruth starts out, Ruth chapter 1, verse 1 through 2, says, "In the day when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem," we start talking about Christmas, you're going to hear Bethlehem dropped a couple of times, "a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife had two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. The name of his two sons are particularly difficult to pronounce and not important to the story, so we're just going to skip over that. So there was a famine in Bethlehem, so they had to go across the Dead Sea to Moab to find food, to sell food, to figure out how to survive the famine. And when Naomi and her husband went across the Dead Sea, settled in Moab, they had a couple of sons, and as sons tend to do, they married a couple of ladies over in Moab that happened to be Moabites, because that's who lives in Moab. And then something happened. Naomi's husband, Elimelech, died. Naomi's sons also died. So we are left in Moab with Naomi and two daughters-in-law. Daughter-in-laws. Daughters-in-law. One of those. A mother-in-law and two daughters-in-law. And she said, "You know, you guys should probably just stay here. I've got no more sons. I'm too old to have any more sons. You guys stay here in your home country. I'm going to go back to my home country. Because I don't know why all of this is happening, but I'm having a real hard time finding God in this. Kind of feels like I've been abandoned. Now, one of the daughters-in-law stayed behind, but one of them, whose name was Ruth, decided to stick around. In fact, she gives one of the most poetic, most beautiful statements to Naomi. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 16 and 17, says, "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you.'" So Ruth says, "I'm staying. I'm going where you're going. I'm staying where you stay. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. I'm going with you." Now, Naomi's dealing with a lot of stuff. She's dealing with the loss of a husband. She's dealing with the loss of sons. She's also dealing culturally with something that it would be significant if it happened now, but it was so much more significant then. An older woman and another woman traveling together, trying to survive together. They didn't have the highest chance of success because women didn't have the highest value in those days. So Naomi goes through this process of just questioning, where is God and why is such calamity fallen on me? She goes back to Bethlehem with Ruth, and of course Naomi was from Bethlehem, so people start chatting and say, "Hey, is that Naomi? It's been a while. She must have been in Moab," yada, yada, yada. And she says to the people, "Don't call me Naomi anymore. My life has taken such a downward turn. I'm changing my name to Mara, which means bitter, because God has forsaken me." And in Ruth chapter 1, verse 21, Naomi speaks and she says, "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi's dealing with some stuff. She feels abandoned. She feels broken. She's suffering grief. And she's suffering fear of how they're possibly going to survive. This was in the middle of the barley harvest. And if you are a barley farmer, then what I'm telling you is not new information. But during the barley harvest, they would harvest the barley. I didn't take a lot of notes on that. But Hebrew law dictated that when you harvest the barley, only take what you could carry. That was in the Hebrew law. And that was one of the ways that they would actually care for the poor and the orphans and the widows, was they would only harvest what they could carry, and then they would allow people to basically scavenge and just come pick up whatever they couldn't carry. That was written into the law. So during the barley harvest, Naomi sends Ruth to scavenge the fields, which was incredibly dangerous for a woman by herself to go through these fields. But they have to survive in some way. So she sends her to the fields. Now understand, Ruth is a foreigner. She's from Moab, and she is back in Bethlehem. And word kind of gets around. We don't know if maybe she was a different shade, or maybe she spoke with a different accent, or certainly a different language, but people know who Ruth is, and they start kind of talking about her and asking questions. Who is this woman? And along comes a gentleman named Boaz. Now, Boaz is impressed with Ruth because he has heard of what has happened. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 11, Boaz is speaking. He says, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. How you left your father and mother in your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So Boaz, this decent guy, gives her a commendation, if you will. "Hey, we've heard about you. We heard how you left everything you knew just to support your mother-in-law. That's cool. God bless you in what you're doing." And in fact, he takes it a step further. He talks to the barley harvesters and he says, "Guys, when you harvest the barley, maybe don't harvest all the barley. You know what I mean? Maybe we leave a little bit more on the ground because he wants to make sure that Ruth and Naomi have enough. So he starts kind of looking after him a little bit. See, in a time where everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes, there were little glimmers, little bright spots, and Boaz was one of those people who remembered God's law, who said, regardless of what the culture is saying, regardless of what the culture is doing, I'm still a decent guy. I remember what God said. I remember what God told us to do and not do. And so he starts kind of looking after these people, these two ladies. Eventually, as time progresses, Naomi kind of has a come to Jesus meeting with Ruth and says, look, I'm old and I'm not getting any younger, and neither are you. And what this family really needs is a kinsman redeemer. Now, a kinsman redeemer was something in that culture that was essentially a well-to-do relative. That if you got in a jam, you would probably need a kinsman redeemer. By law, they had a couple of things that they could do. They could protect an impoverished family. They could repurchase lost property. You know, when you miss a few mortgage payments on your hut and the bank forecloses on it, your kinsman redeemer could come and swoop in and take care of that. Redeem relatives sold as slaves. If you owed a debt, they could put you in slavery, or they could put your children in slavery. So the kinsman redeemer could essentially buy your freedom. And in some cases, they could even be called on to provide for an heir. You know, the patriarchy and the hierarchy was very, very important in this culture. So if you could not produce a male heir, they would bring in a surrogate, a kinsman redeemer, to make that happen for your family. And so Naomi explains to Ruth that we need that to happen. And in order for that to happen, I need you to get Boaz to marry you. No big deal, right? He's been nice to us. Maybe it'll work. There was also the pesky business of a little parcel of land that Naomi owned from her husband. And we don't get a lot of details in this, but being the kinsman redeemer, he would have assumed not only responsibility for Ruth, responsibility for Naomi, responsibility for Ruth's family. The kinsman redeemer just kind of swooped in all of it. He also would assume responsibility for a parcel of land. In some translations, this is cool, I'm not making this up, the kinsman redeemer is known as the avenger. And that's just cool, right? So Ruth, in a very peculiar way, and I would invite you to read the story, read chapter 3 of Ruth on your own. It seems weird, but in a very culturally appropriate way at the time, she essentially woos Boaz. She sleeps at his feet, which seems weird. But that was culturally appropriate at the time, and it wasn't weird. And he agrees to be the kinsman redeemer. Except there's a problem. See, lineage was important, and Boaz had done his research. He said, actually, Boaz was a distant relative of Naomi's husband. And he looked it up, and there's actually someone closer in line. There's someone ahead of me in line. I can't be your kinsman redeemer because there's somebody in the lineage before me, and it wouldn't be right. I can't circumvent the law, you know, even though nobody would know about it. It just isn't right. So we keep getting this little glimmer of Boaz being this guy that does the right thing in a culture where everyone else does the wrong thing. So Boaz goes and talks to the next in line. He goes to the potential kinsman redeemer. We get that conversation in Ruth chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. Boaz says, and he's speaking to the potential kinsman redeemer, he says, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. What that means is basically, you have to produce an heir. So you have to take the land, you have to take the mother-in-law, and you have to take Ruth, and you have to produce an heir, or you at least have to give it a shot. Then the redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So the next in line says, you know what, I got my own stuff going on. I've got my own land to deal with. I've got my own inheritance. This could mess up my inheritance or what I have to split with my kids. And I don't really know anything about Ruth or her family. And I've got to take the whole thing in. You want them, you can have them. I don't need the hassle. So Boaz becomes the kinsman redeemer. And he marries Ruth. Now that could just be like the end of the story. And they all lived happily ever after. Because it's a good story. Some women fall on hard times. A daughter-in-law pledges allegiance to her mother-in-law. And that's just good stuff. You know, and they fall upon the kindness of a guy who's doing the right thing when nobody else is, and he takes him in, and then he ends up marrying him, and that's just good stuff. But it goes beyond that, because this is a story, like I described earlier, where years and years and years and years and years before Mary and Joseph and Jesus showed up, God was decorating for Christmas. Because Ruth and Boaz did get married, and they had a son. His son's name was Obed. And there's this beautiful little nod to that at the end of the book of Ruth, as at the beginning of the book of Ruth, Naomi is just broken and bitter and angry and wondering why this calamity has fallen upon her and her family. And at the end of the book of Ruth, she is holding her grandson as her family has been redeemed. It goes a little bit beyond that because Obed had a son named Jesse. And Jesse had a whole mess of kids. And in the book of 1 Samuel, the word of the Lord came to Samuel the prophet, 1 Samuel 16:1, and he says, this is God speaking to Samuel, he says, "Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." So God is going to pick a king. And he tells Samuel, go to Jesse's house because it's one of his sons. And Jesse's, I mean, that's a good day to be Jesse, because if one of your kids is king, you don't care which one. I mean, you're the father of the king, right? And Samuel lines up all of Jesse's sons. And he goes, of course, first to the oldest, the tallest, the strongest. And God says, no. And he moves down the line and he's not getting the word. And Samuel's like, I'm pretty sure I'm at the right house. Is this all your sons? And Jesse says, well, except the youngest one, but he's out tending the sheep, and trust me, he ain't the king. Samuel says, that's the one. And you can read where David is anointed king. So we go from Obed to Jesse to David. Now, when the prophet Nathan is prophesying to David and about David in 2 Samuel, chapter 7, verse 16, he says, speaking of David, and your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. And the passage that was read as we lit the Advent candle, the proclamation from Jeremiah, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the promise I made to the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In those days and at the time, I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David. He shall execute justice and righteousness. You see, Naomi was broken and bitter and angry and abandoned. And now you can't tell the story of Christ without her. David is significant because we know from our Christmas genealogies, right, that Jesus was the son of David. He was from the house of David. And God redeemed a family through a foreign woman to be a part of that story. Someone who was broken, felt abandoned by God, didn't know what God's plan was, didn't even know if God was in the plan. And now they are mentioned in the story of Christ. This idea of redemption is really what Advent and what Christmas is about. We focus on different words throughout Advent: hope, peace, love, joy. But the hope that we speak of on the first Sunday of Advent is this hope of redemption. Because, see, a long time ago, God walked through his garden and he called out to his creation. And his creation didn't come, because they were broken and they were ashamed. Because for the first time in history, sin became a part of the human equation. And God says, I can redeem that. I can fix that. And he puts into motion a plan A country, a sacred country, a holy country of Israel that would be a light to the Gentiles. And he sets things into motion. He says, you know what? The only way I can redeem the brokenness is to defeat the thing that caused it. I will come and I will defeat sin and death. And I will redeem my creation. And if God can set that kind of plan into motion, if God can execute that kind of plan to redeem his creation, there is absolutely no situation in your life that God cannot redeem. That is the message of Advent, that we can be redeemed. That, yeah, we're broken, and yeah, we sometimes look in situations and we wonder, how is God in this, or is God in this? And God says, no, I can fix that. I'll redeem that. I'll come to the world and I'll die for that. There is nothing so broken that it cannot be redeemed by God. That is the hope of the Christmas message. And when we talk about this word redeemed, we so often use it as it pertains to our salvation, you know, being redeemed and free from our sins, and that's important, and that's good news, and that's great news. But that's not where it ends. God can redeem you spiritually, but God can redeem your situations. He fixes broken stuff. It's just kind of what he does. Relationships that are broken can be redeemed. Situations that are broken can be redeemed because God says, I fix that. That's what I do. When we introduce Emmanuel into the season, this idea of God with us, we are inviting a very special relationship into our existence. Because God can redeem, but it will always change us. For Ruth to be redeemed, she had to say goodbye to everything she knew, to her homeland, to her family, and stand by someone that she knew needed her. For us to be redeemed, we will oftentimes have to step away from something. We will have to make hard choices, but we can echo the words of the song that was sung and say, I'll let go of all I have just to have all of you. No matter what the cost, you fix broken stuff, I'm with you. That's the message of Advent. When we say, oh, come, Emmanuel, it's come and fix our brokenness. Come and be God with us. Come and give us hope that the world can't provide. So anytime we talk about an Old Testament story, I think it's always good to put yourself in the story. And some of you might be thinking, you know what, I'm not that broken. Things are going pretty good. Maybe you see yourself as more of a Boaz in this situation. And that's okay, because the world needs a few more Boaz-like people, guys that just stand up and do the right thing regardless of what's going on around them. But I would venture to say that there are some, if not most, people in here that have experienced brokenness, that have experienced grief, that have experienced abandonment. And the idea of being redeemed from that, from a God who says, I will step down and I will fix that, is a pretty appealing thing. So as we sing, O come, Emmanuel, invite the musicians forward. I would open our altar for prayer. That perhaps there's something that this season you need a little bit more hope. You need to understand a little bit more of God's redeeming power, because that's what God does. When we say, oh, come, Emmanuel, we say, God with us, fix us. That's the hope that you bring to us.